I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 208, The Call from the East, with Peter Frankopan. In our last two episodes, we've asked what the Emperor and the Pope really wanted in the lead-up to the First Crusade. And our guide through the maze of sources has very much been Professor Peter Frankopan. In his book, The First Crusade, The Call from the East, he puts the motives of both men front and center in his account of what happened. And today you'll hear him make his case for why Byzantium should be much more prominent in histories of the First Crusade than it usually is. In the interview, I also ask him about what each man was expecting to happen once the crusade was called. Was Alexius surprised by the huge numbers who volunteered? And did Urban really believe that the crusade would succeed? Peter Frankopan is Professor of Global History at Oxford University and Stavros Niarchos Foundation Director of the Oxford Centre for Byzantine Research. He specialises in the history of the Byzantine Empire, Russia, the Middle East, Central Asia, and China. He translated the Alexiad for Penguin Classics in 2009 and wrote The First Crusade, The Call from the East in 2012, which I obviously highly recommend. Since then, he's written two award-winning books about the Silk Roads, tracing their impact on world history as well as contemporary events. Find out more about his work at peterfrankopan.com. Before we begin, I should just mention one other thing. A couple of episodes ago, I talked about how many of the leaders of the First Crusade were quite familiar with Byzantium thanks to the tradition of pilgrimage in their family networks. Well, one crusade leader I didn't mention was Bohemond, son of Robert Guiscard. Yes, that's the Bohemond, last seen fleeing the Balkans after Alexius finally got the better of him. A decade after that nasty war, Bohemond would sign up to lead a contingent east. And needless to say, confrontations between the two men will be a major plot point going forward. Now, here's the interview. Professor Frankopan, welcome to the History of Byzantium.
Hi there, thank you for tracking me down and having me.
It's a huge pleasure. So what we're going to talk about today is the work you did, particularly that culminated in your book, The First Crusade, The Call from the East. And part of your goal in writing that was to put Byzantium back into narratives of the First Crusade. Can you tell the listeners a bit about why Byzantium has been written out of so many crusading histories?
Well, I guess the real question is, why has Byzantium been written out of so many histories? I mean, in a way, the Crusades is such a sort of touch point for medieval historians, which effectively means Western European medieval historians, that's the kind of natural focal point. But I mean, as a Byzantinist, I've been at my college in Oxford now for 25 years as a fellow there, that I've had these conversations for best part of three decades now about where does Byzantium fit within the story of not just global history, but also specifically European history. I mean, the endless books written about the Crusades that don't mention Byzantium or Constantinople, there's only an intersection point is when the armies coming from the West stop in Constantinople. There's a sort of brief moment there. But that's mirrored in the way in which history is written about across Europe for the whole period of, well, late antiquity, I suppose, or, you know, call it the conversion of Constantine, right up until the fall of Constantinople in 1453. You know, you have to look quite hard to find Byzantium anywhere. And I suppose there are three obvious reasons for that. Number one is that over the last 300-400 years, the Western part of Europe has been the dominant political and economic side of the continent. And so as a result, that's where primary focus has been based. Second, well, what comes with the political and economic strength comes institutional support too, for scholars to write. And so by and large, scholars are focused on those regions too, because that's where the patronage has come from. But then the third reason, I suppose, is that the technical skills that you need to be able to make head or tail of this subject, you know, are not necessarily easier to acquire for Western Europe, but Latin-based, relatively crudely written texts written in the Middle Ages are not that hard to read. Being able to translate, understand texts like the Alexiad, Byzantine texts written in the, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century onwards, is obviously a lot harder. And here in this country, we've basically written away the process of teaching languages as a skill that graduate students and therefore scholars need. So to be an effective Byzantine historian, you know, you need to understand, you don't need to necessarily be able to read Syriac and Armenian, Arabic, Hebrew and so on, but you need to be aware that there are sources in these languages that you need to be very, very careful with. And you need to try and understand the manuscript edition, you need to understand the audience and the reception, you need to understand the way that they're written, the literary context and so on. And I think as a Byzantinist, you're well trained to be on your guard. And that requires a heavier load of research skills and so on. And so one of the reasons why Byzantium disappears is for the technical reasons. One, because the Western side of Europe is the dominant voice and therefore celebrates itself. And I suppose it's also because that Western side of Europe has always been interested in looking at itself in the mirror. So the Crusades are interesting and became interesting. It's no coincidence at a time when Europe was developing colonies around the world and European states were developing colonies. And so it's until very recently, the standard way in which the Crusades and the Crusader states were assessed by European scholars was as sort of proto-colonies, that these were Western interventions in new milieu and no attention paid at all to local and domestic settings. So it's absolutely right. Where's Byzantium in the Crusades? And the answer is it's left out altogether. But Byzantium is shortchanged and deliberately shortchanged and has been for the last 400-500 years. The good news is that as we are here today in 2020, the Byzantine world is, I wouldn't perhaps say it's en vogue. You'll know about that as well, Robin. You know, that there are, you know, smaller audiences for what we do, but they are growing. And the number of graduate students, the number of young early career researchers working on really cutting edge stuff in our field are growing every day, which is fantastic, obviously. But, you know, we're suffering from people like Gibbon writing about the Byzantine Empire and making the word Byzantine synonymous with decadence, synonymous with smoke and mirrors, synonymous with you know, making the Byzantine world sound exotic and untrustworthy. And so perhaps it's no real coincidence that scholarship has struggled to keep up with that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, in a lot of crusade stories that the listeners will have heard, the papacy therefore takes center stage. And we're going to talk about Alexius's role and the Byzantine role in this more generally in a bit. But let's start with where all the other crusading histories start, with the Pope. We've talked a little bit on this podcast about the papal reform movement, this general sense of 11th century popes trying to rid the church of the influence and control of the secular world. But could you tell the listeners just a little bit more about that movement and how it involves the papacy in military affairs?
Well, I don't want to do myself out of a podcast, but I mean, from my perspective, it's completely irrelevant. You know, from the perspective of Constantinople in the 11th century, effectively zero attention is paid to what is going on between the Pope arguing with a bunch of other prelates all over the rest of Europe. So Western medieval historians, they make a big thing about the changes in the church, and it is a big thing from a perspective of Western Europe. It's a big thing from the perspective of the changes in the early medieval church. It's important in terms of the function of the apparatus of the ecclesiastical hierarchy, in terms of the bureaucracies. There are impacts into canon law and so on. But from my side of the Mediterranean or the Ionian Sea, southern Italy, it's totally meaningless. And it's a sort of artificial start point, because Crusade historians will typically, or Western medieval historians will typically use this as a start point to say, aha, well, the church starts to turn at this point, and it leads up to a pope who starts to trigger the Crusade movement. But that seems to me several leaps of faith, almost literally, to be able to jump to that conclusion, because the Pope has significantly intervened in secular and military affairs since the time effectively of St. Peter. You know, the idea that the church hasn't been trying to influence secular societies to put pressure on leaders to try to shape standards and norms in everyday life as well as in high politics, you know, sort of it sort of overlooks 1,000 years of what the church has actually been doing in not just in Byzantium and the Eastern Mediterranean, but all over the Christian world, including, by the way, what the church has been doing in Asia, highly active, highly involved in trying to control and regulate relationships with Sasanian Shahs, with sort of pre-Islamic rulers of Persia, and then post-Islamic rulers of the Umayyad and then the Abbasid Caliphate. So I think as a starting point, the question would be, why pay any attention to what it is that the papal reform movement and arguments between different popes in Rome, particularly Gregory the VII and his sort of attempts to outmaneuver and outbox, particularly Henry the IV in Germany. Number one, you'll find better people to talk about that than me, because it's not something I'm there are people much better than I am to talk about that. But second, I don't understand why that would have any relevance for a Byzantinist, because if you look at the Byzantine sources, they don't even mention it, which would tell you maybe that it's much less important than mainstream scholarship seems to think.
Mm, very interesting. Well, what about Urban II himself? He ends up preaching the Crusade, and a part of your book is putting his personal situation in its context in a way that isn't often mentioned. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about the situation he was in from when he came to power up to when he called the Crusade?
Yes, I mean, I guess the two most basic questions about the what has become known as the First Crusade, the two most basic questions are, number one, if the Pope and the knighthood of Europe were so predisposed towards recovering Jerusalem, why haven't they done that before? And your listeners will know about Gregory the VII and his attempts to get things off the ground in the 1070s. And, you know, no one tunes in. No one's interested. There are a couple of nice supportive letters, you know, basically emails coming in saying, I'm really busy right now, but thanks for letting me know. And there's zero, there's no ability of the Pope to move the needle. And so one of the questions is, what is it about Urban or about the mid-1090s that creates the kind of response that is unprecedented in Europe? So we think, you know, the rough size of the Crusader forces or Western forces that move towards Jerusalem is somewhere between 80 and 100,000, something of that magnitude. And that's at a time when, you know, the Norman conquest of England is achieved with a force of maybe 3,000 or 4,000, or, you know, whatever one wants to argue. But it's a totally out of proportion response. So one needs to work out how to explain that. I'll come back to Urban in a second. But the second most important question is that if Jerusalem really matters to Christians, why is it that there's a response then? Why now? And why haven't they done it before? And I suppose when I was a young undergraduate and I did a paper at university about Byzantium, when I did my first essay about this exact subject, and my assumption had been, well, I needed to read about and gather a bit of information, knowledge, and to build up base knowledge. And I had just assumed that, you know, my shaky history from school, that Jerusalem must have fallen to the Muslim forces you know, just before the First Crusade. You know, the First Crusade, Urban calls for support in 1095, so must have been in, you know, 1094, 1093, just on the immediate eve. And in fact, you know, as I've known for 30 years, in fact, Jerusalem falls from Christian hands in the 630s, you know, which is 450 years earlier. So the idea that suddenly the Pope wakes up one day in Europe, light bulb comes on, he's never been able to move men before, and is able to generate that kind of response, we need to think a little bit harder about it than to just put all chips, throw them on the table, go, Urban turns up in a field in Clermont, gives a quite an exciting speech. We've all been to church or to whichever your place of worship or to school assembly, whatever your equivalent wants to be, where the headmaster or the archbishop or the imam or the rabbi has said something that really moves you. We've all done that. But it's very rare that it's moved you enough to go home, sell your stuff, pack your things, leave your family and take your life in your hands. So something very specific is going on in the mid 1090s. As it happens, Urban, far from being a kind of galvanizing force within the church, in the mid 1090s, Rome is so split that Urban himself is not even inside the city. He's not able to gain entry into the city himself. His predecessor, but one, Gregory the VII, is an enormously divisive figure within the church. He's bullish, he's demanding, he's insisting on reforms, and picks a fight not just with Henry IV, who's the German emperor. He's the prime political figure, a military figure in northern and central, and basically in meridional Italy too, northern part of Italy too. Gregory picks fights with everybody, including the Normans, who become the dominant force in southern Italy at that time. And eventually Henry IV snaps, and in 1080 appoints one of his trusted henchmen, Wibert of Ravenna, Archbishop of Ravenna, and brings him to Rome, kicks the Pope out, and appoints and crowns Wibert as Clement III, as the Pope. And for all those lands in which Henry is recognized, which is the lion's part of Europe, the Pope at that time is not Urban II, it's Clement III. And so Urban, a slightly sorry figure, he'd been connected to the great monastery at Cluny, the sort of intellectual nuclear power station of Europe, well connected, but politically, militarily, and in terms of networks, is extremely weak, poorly connected, and facing a bureaucratic rival set up with the protection of the German emperor. So Urban is, to be able to explain how is he able to galvanize, how is Europe able to respond to his call in at Clermont above all, we need to work much, much harder than the glib, superficial texts, all written about by the Western contemporaries, or written in the late 1000s and early 1100s, that begin the story by saying Pope Urban found himself in a field in central France and gave an electric speech that galvanized Europe, which is where the Gesta Francorum, where effectively Raymond of Aguiar, where Fulcher of Chartres, where the story begins. And that's really where the story begins for crusade historians of today too, because they are unconvinced that sounds quite right. They start the story, as I mentioned, with the kind of reform movement, that somehow that's tacked onto the beginning. But to find the explanations and origins of the crusades, not just we have to look harder, we need to look in a different location. And of course, won't surprise you and your listeners to know that's in the Byzantine Empire, number one, but also in the Middle East and in the Holy Land itself.
Mm. Well, absolutely. One of the main arguments of your book, as I understand it, is that the campaign would never have been called for by Urban unless the Byzantines were essentially lobbying him specifically to do so. So can you tell the listeners more about the messages coming from Constantinople and from Byzantium in general, this push for Western recruitment?
Well, it breaks down into different elements. So the calls for support from Alexius and from others have one category. The meltdown and collapse within Byzantium is a separate one, where the Byzantine state is entirely weakened. And then the third is the specific changes in and around Jerusalem in the 1090s as well. And all of those can be separated and split out one by one. So if one starts with what happens in the Holy Land itself, pilgrimage has, since the time of Jesus Christ, has attracted the faithful to want to come and see the places where Jesus Christ was born and was crucified and rose from the dead and so on, was a hugely important part of Christian faith. And in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, large-scale pilgrimage became perhaps not quite a sort of a tourist business, but it became an important part of what it is that Christians did, particularly from Western Europe, to come to visit those locations. There was lower levels of Byzantine pilgrimage to Jerusalem, partly because many of the artifacts and great artifacts of Christianity were held in Constantinople. But Western Europeans, and particularly wealthy elites, aristocrats and so on, undertook long journeys to go and visit the sites and to then come back home, and it gained considerable kudos. And as I think everybody knows, the act of devotion and a pilgrimage is an important part of just about every single faith. I don't know about how it works for Jedis, but Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims and Jews and Christians, going on journeys to again visit holy places and paying devotion and putting God first is a hugely important part of the story of what it means to be faithful. And in the 1070s and 1080s, there is a change in the Middle East, a contemporary what's now sort of Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Syria, where the advent of Turks who've taken over rulership of the caliphate in Baghdad start to push at the Fatimid caliphate in Fustat in Cairo in Egypt. And that leads to a shutdown of pilgrim traffic because it's hard to travel through war zones. It leads to persecutions because one of the things that when there are wars is that there's a targeting of minorities. And from what we can tell from the material and of the evidence, life becomes difficult in the 1080s and 1090s for not just people moving towards Jerusalem, but for people living there too. There are whispers and snips of information that show that some local leaders are more willing to compromise and deal with Jews and Christians in particular, helping to rebuild churches and so on. But this becomes a very difficult time in the Holy Land. And we see that from Sophronius, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, sending out messages saying life is becoming very difficult. There is a kind of war going on between over-competitive or highly competitive, I should say, factions of Shia Muslims on the one hand and Sunnis on the other, which are uncompromising and for whom Jerusalem is also, of course, for Muslims, a very important religious site too. So the position in the Holy Land itself becomes increasingly difficult, and it looks like that happens with a sharp uptick in the 1090s and not so much beforehand. There are a few bits and pieces that suggest that there's economic and demographic pressure, but the 1090s things seem to become decisively harder. From the perspective of the Byzantine Empire, the biggest challenge is that the main source for this period is the Alexiad of Anna Komnene. And because we don't read that text well, because we don't read it in its entirety, because we don't ask the right questions about how and when it was written, what its audience was, there's an assumption that there's always been an assumption that it's a work of history, that it's a narrative history rather than a work of literature. And that means that basic questions about its narrative structure are not even asked. So there's an assumption that chapter one leads to chapter two, leads to chapter three, leads to chapter four, and it's all happening in sequence. And often people point out the contradictions and the problems, but, you know, in the words of Gibbon, this is a work written by a woman, therefore can't be trusted. Or by the way, that's what Jonathan Riley Smith, probably the greatest of modern Crusade historians, also said. He said, this is written by an old woman living in a convent. What does she know? Even though, of course, as an aside, all the monks who wrote about the First Crusade were all men living in monasteries thousands of miles away, where Anna had access to imperial archives. She, we know, was alive and living in Constantinople at the time. She was an eyewitness to many of the events and met many of the protagonists, certainly on the Byzantine side, maybe on others too. But so the biggest challenge with that is that Anna has a very strong vested interest to show that the Byzantine Empire is on fire by the time her father takes the throne in 1081. And what's clear, both by unpicking the chronological structure of the Alexiad, and there are many other sources too written in that period, you know, from monks' lives, from imperial charters and so on that we can gather together. but also looking at the numismatic, the coin evidence, and the evidence from sigillography, from lead seals, we can build up a picture that's extremely compelling and widespread that shows that the Byzantine Empire, in fact, despite the kind of the truism that Manzikert sounds the death knell, actually is in pretty good shape, well, long into the 1080s. And the crisis point really starts to happen around about the spring of 1090, where first there's a massive migration of Pechenegs steppe nomads deep into Thrace. It's been an ongoing challenge for a while. And second, the deals that Alexius has cut in Asia Minor to try to keep the situation stable with larger numbers of Turkish settlers and raiders in the subcontinent, those deals that Alexius has struck with strongmen leaders start to go wrong for various reasons. Suleiman of Nicaea dies, and his replacement is less willing to cooperate, at least to start with. Individual cities start to have overlords or potentates like Chakas or Chaka in Smyrna, who see that there is opportunity in the kind of paralysis to make a name and to make money and to make profits for yourselves. And the sudden collapse in Byzantium really happens even after the Pechenegs are defeated in 1091, where over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, military problems on the frontier with Serbia, replacement of the Pechenegs with new steppe nomad threats by the Cumans, who are, you know, similar sort of problem to the Pechenegs, and a rapidly deteriorating situation in Asia Minor, which really does bring Turks into control of major cities, or at least leave cities isolated from the and disconnected from their own hinterland, suddenly means that the pressures facing the emperor are acute. And in the winter of 1094, winter 1094-1095 campaign season, Alexius is faced with a revolt led by his own relatives, including his at least one of his brothers, at least one of his brothers-in-law, and the high command of the imperial army. And that's not just about Alexius' personality. That's effectively a vote of no confidence that the situation in Byzantium is becoming absolutely catastrophic. And suddenly, the big challenge that Constantinople has is multiple threats at the same time. And with Asia Minor, with the northwestern Balkans and the Serbs, the northeastern Balkans with steppe nomads, suddenly the collapse of Constantinople from a political and economic, large numbers of migrants and refugees coming to the city, there's a demand for a replacement of the emperor, which leads to a very dramatic set piece where Alexius in the imperial tent on campaign has to line up his Varangian guard, the Scandinavians, Anglo-Saxons and Rus soldiers who have double-headed axe. They surround him in a phalanx. He appears in front of the army, or at least the officers, not dressed as an emperor, but in military uniform. Alexius had been a general before he became emperor. His whole reason why he took power was to stem the tide. And Alexius faces them down in a moment of profound tension. And when you read the text of the Alexiad, that's captured incredibly effectively by Anna, where it's absolutely touch and go about whether Alexius will be torn apart there and then, or whether he can stare down the challenge. And it seems to me that the biggest problem that Alexius has is that in Asia Minor, at least, possession by the Turks of well-defended cities is the key problem. And the problem above all is on the city of Nicaea, which is the sort of the gateway into Asia Minor. It's south, it's modern Iznik, south of the Bosphorus, but it's the first real major city, apart from Nicomedia, it's the first real city that you reach that controls access to the coastal strip, which is the rich, fertile valleys, as well as as well as shipping, of course, and also controls the routes into the interior that ultimately lead as far as Antioch. And the problem with that is that Alexius has quite a well-worn and weary army that is not ineffective against Serbs and Pechenegs, Cumans, if they're well-led and so on. But it's a very different story taking on a really large, well-fortified city. And Alexius, from his dealings with the Normans in the 1080s, personally, and also is well-known in Byzantium, that the Westerners and the Latins, or the Franks as they're called, are extremely effective at both castle building, but also in setting sieges against big targets. So the key for Alexius, for his personal survival and for the survival of the empire, is the recovery in the first instance of Nicaea, and then ideally also Antioch, which is the kind of the plug to the Byzantine underbelly in what's now Syria and in Eastern Asia Minor. And the way in which Alexius then sets about trying to gather support is through multiple different ways of sending out appeals to individual leaders in Western Europe, some of whom he's dealt with before, and also an approach to the Pope where envoys reach him in Piacenza in March 1095. Now, those appeals are relatively disjointed in terms of building the picture together. You have to work quite hard to find individual sources. One would expect, you know, not unreasonably, Western medievalists will ask, well, where's all the evidence? You know, if it's so obvious, then where are the triggers? Why do you have to look so hard for them? And there are three very good reasons for that. Number one, the crusade becomes an enormous success from a crusader point of view and from a papal point of view with the capture of Jerusalem in 1099. And of course, at that point, it becomes quite useful to give credit to the people who've led it, above all the crusade leaders and to the Pope. So finding a Western European origin is key. Second, and combined with that, there's a fallout during the crusade, a spectacular bust up, where it becomes clear to the crusaders in Antioch in 1098, after a very long siege that's cost a lot of lives and so on, it becomes clear to the crusaders that they now need to make decisions on the hoof about what is going to happen if and when they get to Jerusalem, and who shall be in control of these cities, including Antioch. And for all sorts of reasons that maybe we'll talk about, the Byzantine well gets poisoned. And pushing Byzantium out of the picture is part of that process that ultimately leads to the denigration of Byzantium for the next millennium, which is why we started the podcast talking about where is Byzantium in the story of the Crusades and in the story of the Middle Ages. It's because Byzantium is a very inconvenient truth in the story of where this all triggered from. So Byzantium has to get written out. And the third thing is that, well, you know, we have very little information from any of these sources, both in Byzantium and from the West, that present a compelling picture about why is it that 80, 90, 100,000 men head eastwards. And one has to, I think, use one's common sense, as well as these the snips of information of Alexius sending relics, of directly sending appeals, the most famous of which is a letter to Robert of Flanders that is dismissed routinely as a forgery, but would seem to have some kind of basis in the communication and the understanding there is regular communication between Constantinople and leaders like Robert of Flanders that we know Alexius met personally when Robert came back from pilgrimage in the 1080s, that there is an assumption that there are high-level contacts going on, and that there's a need to fabricate or to distort information and appeals for help in somebody's interests. And there's a long discussion amongst scholars about what exactly that letter shows. At its very least, it shows that there's a need to dismiss the Byzantines as a factor in the Crusades. And that seems to me extremely significant, that the negative evidence of pushing people out of the story, as that letter tries to do or seems to try to do. I take a slightly different view on it, by the way. This letter is written in the beginning of the 1100s. It would seem to show that there is a competition for control of the narrative of the Crusade. And in that one, there's an awareness in Western Europe that Byzantium is a very complicated strand that needs to be darkened, and it needs to be dismissed. And that seems to be a consistent story that goes through other accounts by Gilbert Nogent, by Baldric of Dol, by all the other Crusade historians writing in the early 1100s, of how do you repackage the story to move away from its proper origins. And those proper origins, the only explanation for why the West rises after 450 years, why suddenly so many men travel eastwards, etc., all lie in the fundamental truth that the Byzantine Empire and the Holy Land are on their knees, and that the level of stress, the level of anxiety, the level of collapse is so acute and so high that people in Western Europe know that this is true. They know that the calls from the East, from Alexius, from churchmen, from clerics and so on, they know that this is not something that is being puffed up and it's a PR stunt, which was the case when Gregory VII tried the same sort of thing in the 1070s, where he tried to get men to go eastwards. People didn't respond, not because the Pope hadn't reformed, not because they were too busy. It's because there was an awareness that actually the situation wasn't all that bad. Whereas in 1095, it really is catastrophic. And we see that also from the Byzantine side. In fact, the fact that the attempt to murder Alexius by his own, involving at least involving his own family, possibly even engineered by his own family, show that this really is a crisis, and it's not just about his personality.
Fantastic. Well, that's the kind of argument I wanted the listeners to hear, and we could of course go on and discuss all sorts of interesting things beyond the calling of the crusade, but that's where we've reached in our podcast. So I'm going to end with two more questions just about the calling, and we may well be in the realm of speculation, but since I have you on the phone, I feel I have to ask. Obviously a big debate is what size of army did Urban think he was going to recruit? What size of army did Alexius really want? And do you get a sense from the sources of whether Alexius did ever imagine he'd have, you know, such a large army coming? Would he have been pleased with that, or was he always imagining something much smaller?
I think it's a really good question. I think what matters to Alexius is the quality, rather than as much the number. And I don't mean quality as in, are you a fighter, or are you part of the rabble that comes with Peter the Hermit or Peter the Cuckoo? What Alexius needs are people who can take down fortified locations, and that seems to be the crux that Urban, first of all, keeps saying on his various travels around Europe. He really puts his back into it, because from Urban's point of view, there is the prospect of not just establishing himself as the main leader of the church in Europe at the expense of Clement III, but also, of course, of being presenting a single united Christian world of the Byzantines too, post 1054, when there'd been the big fallout between the East and Western churches. What Urban, as he travels around Europe and travels around France, I should say, and Italy, and sends letters left, right, and centre, what he keeps saying is that this is not something for the weak-minded or people who can pick up a sword. This is for people who have got specific technical skills and who are able to actually deliver military success. And when the first wave of crusaders reach Constantinople, which are led by Peter the Hermit, it's a sort of ramshackle band of fantasists, nutters, men with pitchforks, children, etc. The shock that reaches in Byzantium is obvious, and Anna Komnina writes about this, saying, you know, they're sort of a bunch of clowns who all arrive, and the emperor wasn't expecting he was expecting armed forces. And it's no coincidence, I think, that the first thing that happens when the crusaders reach Constantinople, and there's real anxiety, by the way, as each army in turn arrives, the big armies led by Godefroy of Bouillon, by Bermond, by Raymond of Toulouse, and so on, and Robert of Normandy, Robert of Flanders, is to keep them out of Constantinople and keep them away from the city, because the threats to the emperor's life are still acute. But it's no coincidence that the first target is Nicaea, that they're all put right next to Nicaea, where a little fort has been built, or a little camp has been built ready for there to host them. And the target then with Nicaea, and what Anna, again, I think faithfully captures, she says, Alexius couldn't believe that when these guys arrived, the first thing they started to do was build siege engines and start to work out how to tackle the walls. And the assumption was that from the Byzantine way, how you strangle a big city is you surround it, you cut it off. And I think that they are amazed that many people arrive and are able to storm the city. I think that's a real eye opener for the Byzantines. So do they expect a large number? I think that there is a pressure to get lots of men. I think that's clear from the amount of effort that Urban puts in. None of the crusaders, with the size of the armies, none of the accounts complain about lack of provisioning on their way to Constantinople, at the imperial capital, or afterwards. And as your listeners may know, all crusaders complain about that on every single other later expedition to Jerusalem. So that tells me that there is sufficient food and there is sufficient infrastructure in place to enable the transit of 80 to 100,000 people through Byzantine territory, which is quite something, particularly through a stressed empire. So there has been planning to anticipate these numbers. It's no surprise, I think, that although Urban calls the Council of Clermont, starts putting his elbows into it in November 1095, there is a kind of official start point in August 1096 when armies start to get moving. Those armies don't all move at the same time, which suggests that there's coordination. They all reach Byzantium at different moments and at different entry points, which suggests, again, there's coordination. And like I said, there is no complaints about provisioning. Occasionally, the Crusaders go haywire and sack and attack people. The Burman's lot burn a couple of castles when they go off piste. But that level of organization suggests that the Byzantines are not only expecting, but able to deal with those large numbers. And that seems to me extremely significant. In terms of the question of how do you calculate how many you need, I think that I've got no idea how one even asks about it. But the logistical preparations are what really are significant, I think, here.
Absolutely. Well, this is not really, you know, a topic covered in your book, but it just kept coming up in my mind, and scholars don't seem to address it. So final question, and again, pure speculation, but do you think Urban expected the crusade to capture Jerusalem? Because it's not clear to me whether he really understood the logistics that they were going to have to overcome. And I just don't know if he thought, well, even if this fails, I'm happy because they've responded to my call, or if he really thought, no, this will succeed. I'm confident and I have some sense of what's needed to succeed.
Great question, Robin. And the truth is, I don't know. I think what happens in Antioch in 1098 is the key here, because it suddenly starts to dawn on the sort of the big shots in the crusade that there isn't a plan. And the truth is that we can use modern parallels to understand how these big initiatives can be put into place without a big plan. So, you know, when US forces went into Iraq in 2003, you know, there no thought had been given through to in what way would the withdrawal happen, what form of government would take over and when, what kind of support would US troops, the military and and the political establishment provide. And suddenly you're left with having to deal with policy on the hoof. And I think that's a very good parallel, in fact, for what happens in the case of the Crusades, that the excitement, the specific military targets, because, you know, after Nicaea, the Crusaders are shuttled on to Antioch. They don't stop anywhere else. There's no need for them to put pressure on any other city. The big targets are the ones that the Crusaders are most effective about against. And in Antioch, it becomes, I think, a different story, where the Crusaders suddenly start to realize that, does this mean that some of them are going to have to stay there? Are there opportunities for people thinking on their feet like Burmans? Is there a chance to carve out your own space? Is there some form of imperial service or imperial overlordship where you can rule a city or territory, perhaps with the kind of blessing of the emperor in the way that the Byzantines have done quite well in southern Italy for centuries beforehand? You know, are there patronage networks that might emerge? And I think it's a story that starts to redevelop. But I think that we shouldn't necessarily think that all the right questions have been asked, because our own personal experience in the last couple of decades shows quite often that doesn't happen. Trillions of dollars spent in interventions in the Middle East without thinking about the end game or who needs to stay behind or how do things get done. And I suspect in the case of the First Crusade, it's something similar. I mean, what's clear from the charter evidence in Western Europe is that all of these knights, they are heading off east to get to Jerusalem. So fighting in Nicaea or Antioch, you know, it's all a byproduct. The fact that they do storm Nicaea and subject Antioch to a siege of 8-9 months says a lot, I think, about the structure of the crusade and who's really in control. And until that point, until Antioch falls, the Byzantines are the ones calling the shots. After that, and the heading to Jerusalem and figuring that it's not enough to just capture it, perhaps people need to stay there, perhaps supplies need to be thought about, perhaps infrastructure, perhaps appointments, perhaps a bureaucracy. That all seems to develop and emerge on the hoof rather than be thought about in advance.
Fantastic. A great analogy to modern times. I think we'll have to let you go there, but obviously strongly recommend anyone interested in the Crusades check out The Call from the East. Professor Frankopan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure, Robin. And I hope one day you'll have me back to talk about something else too.
That would be fantastic.
Fantastic.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.